This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Thousands of people are expected to line the streets of London later today to watch a procession taking Queen Elizabeth's coffin from Buckingham Palace to Westminster Hall. The Queen's body arrived in London earlier this morning. King Charles, Camilla, the Queen Consort and other members of the royal family were there to receive it. Reporter Sally Sarah is in London.
It's been a real change in London today, Sabra. There was almost a sense of business as usual this afternoon, and then really there's a real solemn feeling in the city with the arrival of the coffin and the Queen's body arriving at Buckingham Palace. People were lining the streets of London as the hearse came through. It has glass in the back, and that was lit up so that people could see the coffin passing by. So I think it's been a real change in tone, and people are now preparing for the big procession, which will happen tomorrow London time, later today Australian time. So I think because the Queen's body has been in Scotland, it's really hit home with people here in London today about what is to come between now and the funeral.
And that procession from Buckingham Palace to Westminster Hall, what can we expect?
This will be a very big formal procession. The coffin carrying the Queen's body, that will be placed on a gun carriage which will be drawn by horses. The members of the royal family will be on foot for part of this procession, and there will also be a very, very large military component. Streets have been blocked off and barricades have been put up in expectation of a very large crowd as people converge on central London to see this procession and then begin queuing up so that they can pay their respects when the Queen lies in state at Westminster Hall for the next 4 days.
Now, you've already said that the mood has sort of changed and it's pretty sombre. Have you spoken with anyone? Are people getting into position now?
Some were earlier today. The rain, I think, has changed some people's plans, but many people are hoping to be out very early in the morning tomorrow. Some of the city officials are expecting that the queue of mourners who want to pay their respects at Westminster Hall, they're expecting that queue to be several kilometres long at its peak, and the Queen will lie in state around the clock between the end of the day and also dawn on Monday morning London time. So those crowds are expected to be very, very big. I just spoke with a mother and daughter who were in the crowd outside Buckingham Palace as the hearse carrying the Queen's body arrived.
You've seen this on the news all day today. You've seen the coffin, you've seen it draped in the royal standard, the flowers on the top, and then to kind of see it in real life just going past was emotional. Yeah.
What about for you?
It's the same, watching it on the television the last few days and then really having it in front of you. It was, and she's on her way back to her home today before she goes on her further journey.
How would you describe the mood of the crowd? It was hard to get a sense of how people were reacting.
Yeah, we heard some people cheering in the distance and kind of that didn't feel right, but I can understand that was an emotion. And then a bit further up from where we were stood, there were some people applauding. But again, when it came to us, we were just very silent and just, yeah, very sombre just watching it go past.
Some of the mourners watching the procession in London, and they were speaking with our reporter Sally Sarah. The agency running the National Disability Insurance Scheme's acknowledging it's taking too long to get people out of hospital and into community accommodation. The federal government says on any given night about 1,500 people with disability are stuck in hospital. It's now taking measures to change that, and that's being welcomed by people with disability. Annie Guest reports.
The stormy night when Dinesh Palapana's car aquaplaned and rolled became the first of many to be spent in hospital as a quadriplegic patient. Now a doctor, he still has vivid memories of those hospital stays.
I did write about the transition after spending months and months in a hospital. I was institutionalised and I was scared and it was such a difficult experience.
And how big a difference do you think it would have made to you, albeit pre-NDIS, but if that discharge system had been more efficient at that time?
It would have made a massive difference.
The Federal Minister for the NDIS, Bill Shorten, says on any given night, about 1,500 people with disability are stuck in hospital, unable to be discharged because there's no other accommodation for them. It's something Di Winkler from the Summer Foundation knows a lot about. She co-authored research with La Trobe University.
So the main problem is not a lack of disability housing. There are over 3,000 vacancies in disability housing across Australia. And our research shows that there are two main barriers to discharge. One is the NDIS bureaucracy, and the second is the need for skilled support to navigate the NDIS.
Bill Shorten has now set a target of making sure an NDIS participant is contacted within 4 days of being medically fit to be discharged and has their NDIS plan in place within 30 days. That'll mean embedding more NDIS staff with hospital rehab teams. Samantha Connor from People with Disability Australia cautions it only addresses part of the problem.
We're talking about people who are living in hostels, people who are living in aged care settings. You know, people are living in places which aren't home.
The NDIS's latest quarterly report says almost 5,000 participants are seeking specialist accommodation, including one-third who need high physical support.
I think the constructive way forward is to start looking at housing and social housing and making sure that we've got safe, livable, affordable, accessible housing.
An NDIA spokesperson says the agency is aware of the need to reduce the time some people with disability are waiting to move from hospital to community accommodation, and that it's working with states and territories to improve the NDIS.
Annie Guest reporting. The official declaration of the third La Niña wet season in a row will, no doubt, cause anxiety in flood-hit regions along the east coast. In New South Wales, the storm season will come before the state government's had time to put in place all of the recommendations from its flood inquiry. Emergency services say they're prepared, but they're urging people to be as self-sufficient as possible. Isabel Rowe prepared this report.
Today, residents stuck on roofs and lives at risk.
For thousands of people along the east coast, this year's flood disaster was sudden and unexpected. This wet season, authorities say they don't want anyone taken by surprise.
For those people that have already experienced flooding, it's quite an upsetting prospect that that might happen again.
Macquarie University Associate Professor Mel Taylor is travelling through the New South Wales Northern Rivers and Southeast Queensland, interviewing flood victims as part of her research into preparedness. She says just like many households have bushfire plans, even more people should be preparing a flood plan.
A lot of the time, some of the things you need to do are exactly the same. You know, knowing what your risks are, knowing what your escape route's going to be, and planning for your animals.
Mel Taylor says people should expect emergency services to be overwhelmed and says it's better for communities to be self-sufficient.
If we can get more people to be self-reliant, more communities to work together to consider what they could do to help each other. We see a lot of that when something actually happens, but of course it'd be much nicer to have a lot of that preparation and that sort of connection ahead of time. Just like the Royal Fire Services can't have a fire truck at every street corner or every house, clearly, the emergency services in this case, they can't have a boat, for everybody.
Because a third La Niña in a row is so unusual, the Bureau of Meteorology says it doesn't know how much rainfall to expect. But the ground is already soaked from previous heavy rain and floods. And New South Wales State Emergency Service spokesman Adam Jones says that puts a large area on alert.
We don't know where this flooding's going to be. No flood is the same. And it's really important that across the whole state, we're prepared. We have been continually training up our volunteers. We've been implementing new assets and equipment, particularly around a high clearance vehicle that's just been announced.
An inquiry into the New South Wales floods released last month recommended disbanding the state government department charged with responding to disasters before the next storm season. The inquiry found it was slow, confusing, and couldn't respond properly to people's needs. A spokesman for the New South Wales government says further implementation is needed to reshape Resilience New South Wales, and so the body will still be there come summer. But he says the changes will not impact frontline services.
Isabel Rowe reporting there. China's leader Xi Jinping will leave China today for the first time since the COVID pandemic began more than 2.5 years ago. He's heading to Central Asia, where he's expected to meet Vladimir Putin and give the Russian leader a much-needed show of diplomatic support. Here's East Asia correspondent Bill Birtles.
If ever a leader needed support, it's Vladimir Putin. Shunned and sanctioned by the West for his invasion of Ukraine, he still has a friend in Beijing. With the Russian army retreating in recent days from several strategic towns they held in Ukraine's east, he's even faced rare criticism from Russian nationalists. But ahead of their meeting this week, a top Chinese official and Xi Jinping loyalist Li Jianshu visited Russia and heaped praise upon Mr. Putin.
Under the leadership of President Putin, Russia's economy has fended off the severe sanctions assault from the US and the West. The economy is clearly headed in a good direction. China thinks Russia is an important investment country and vows to strengthen cooperation in all fields.
Xi Jinping is expected to meet Vladimir Putin in Uzbekistan on Thursday or Friday, where both men are attending a summit. Alexander Korolev, a Russia and China relations specialist at the University of New South Wales, says having Xi Jinping himself show support will be very important for Mr. Putin.
I think, first of all, it signals to the West that Russia is not alone, so it does have some powerful friends, and that it shows that China is willing not only to continue business as usual with Russia, but even show some explicit support.
Officially, China says it has a neutral stance on Russia's Ukraine invasion, but Xi Jinping has increased trade with Russia and ordered state media in China to present a pro-Russia bias throughout the war. In recent days, his envoy Li Jianshu told Russian legislators that China supports Moscow's vital interests, particularly regarding Ukraine. Alexander Korolev.
The problem that Xi is faced with is this dramatic deterioration of China's relations with the United States. And within China, there are many hawks who also anticipate military confrontation with the United States. Maybe not right now, but very soon.
Having shunned overseas summits or dialed in remotely for more than 2 years, Xi Jinping is making a big statement by travelling to meet Vladimir Putin. Next month, he'll almost certainly break norms and be granted a third term as China's leader, a huge change that's taken him years to engineer. Wu Qiang, a political scientist and commentator in Beijing, says it's a show of confidence.
Xi has learned a lot from Putin, but he now wants to dominate the China-Russia relationship. When the Russian troops are defeated, when Russia is isolated, it consolidates ties and helps form a China-Russia axis.
Wu Qiang, an independent political commentator in Beijing, speaking with Bill Birtles. It's a terrifying thought, having to give evidence in a legal case but not fully understanding what's being said. It's a situation that confronts many Aboriginal people in courtrooms as witnesses or the accused. There's concern it's leading to miscarriages of justice. A group of judges has now ditched their robes and headed bush in Western Australia to learn more about Aboriginal culture and communication to ensure everyone gets a fair hearing. Erin Park from the National Regional Reporting Team accompanied them.
In the hot, dusty bush of the West Kimberley, more than 20 judges are hearing the confronting history of law and order in outback Australia.
People call them magical places. I've actually been there. I've seen a lot of bones, the village of the hidden bones.
Their tour guide is Walmajari and Nyingana man Edwin Lee Mulligan, who doesn't shy away from uncomfortable historical truths. Up until the 1940s, local men accused of crimes were shackled together with iron neck chains and marched long distances to attend court.
Amazing stories, and you know, sad story too at the same time, but it's also our history, not only for the Indigenous history, but also European history. It is our history.
The tour is part of a cultural immersion camp attended by more than 20 judges from Perth, Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane. Chief Judge Julie Wager from the District Court of Western Australia says it's been an eye-opener.
I think every judicial officer really wants to make sure that Aboriginal people get a fair deal and that they feel heard and safe in court. But we need to have the knowledge to do that, and we need to make sure that we're not ignorant about really complex Aboriginal issues.
Merrillbeen. Hello, I'm a Merrillbeen person. My name is David Newry.
One of the locals they're learning from is interpreter David Newry, who regularly translates for witnesses, victims and alleged offenders in court. He's given the judges a crash course in common misunderstandings.
For example, like if someone is asked who was there as a witness, they're not able to bring that out because of cultural protocol. You know, those are some of the things that really the court doesn't really understand. And, you know, they might think, oh, he's hiding something, but he's not. He's abiding by his cultural obligation.
He says some people are ending up in jail because they don't understand the charges and the options available to them.
We've seen many of that case, you know, when people are asked the question, have you got anything to say? And then people just don't want to talk because they feel embarrassed because they're not able to speak English. And then therefore they just get sentenced for something that they don't really know what they're there for sometimes.
WA Supreme Court Judge Stephen Hall says there's a growing awareness of the cultural complexities.
We don't often appreciate why they can't talk about things. So I think we're doing a good job, but we're on a road of continuous improvement.
And you yourself personally, how confident are you that an Aboriginal person entering a system and a space that they can at least understand what's going on?
Probably I couldn't say I was confident about it. What I would say is I think we're aware of the problems, so it means that we can try and obtain that information from other people, get cultural awareness advisors in, people who will assist the court. And so I think it is something that, because we're very willing, that it is going to improve over time.
And that's WA Supreme Court Judge Stephen Hall ending that report from Erin Park. Australian exporters are benefiting from increasing demand for halal-certified products. Companies are finding markets in Southeast Asia and the Middle East, as Nassim Kadem reports.
In Melbourne's northern suburbs, Batul Turka runs a health food store that's also selling halal-certified cosmetics. She says young Muslim women are a growing customer base.
We've seen a massive increase in young mums wanting to purchase low-tox, clean products.
That's because her customers don't want to use makeup that contains certain animal products or alcohol.
Halal cosmetics just means that the ingredients that they are using are halal certified, because it's very common in skincare and makeup, cosmetic, etc., to use animal fats as emulsifiers, to use alcohol as preservatives.
The cosmetics are made by a company called Total Beauty Network. Its CEO, Tony Retchman, says it's been selling the range into Maya and David Jones for years. But the family-owned business is now tapping into overseas demand for Australian products that are vegan, organic and halal certified.
And globally, we'll sell in countries like Malaysia, the Middle East, the US, the UK. And today, we're in about 36 countries globally and growing.
The world's 1.9 billion Muslims spent about $3 trillion in 2021 across the food, pharmaceutical, cosmetics, fashion, travel and media and recreation sectors. This was an almost 9% increase in spending from the year before. Singapore, Indonesia and Malaysia are the top destinations for Australian exports that are halal certified.
They're looking for the clean, green, certified Australian products, and halal is an additional benefit, particularly in a country where the major religion is Islam.
Philip Holm is the CEO of Dollar Sweets, which manufactures confectionery and cake decorations in Melbourne's east. It's already exporting to Southeast Asia and is hoping to expand to the Middle East.
We've had a lot of success in the last 12 months in those markets, so we're hoping that in the next 12 months it exceeds 15% of our turnover.
But it's not just smaller private businesses seizing the export opportunity. Alistair Symington is the CEO of ASX-listed company Blackmores.
Our ambition is to reach 1 billion consumers by 2025.
Blackmores exports halal certified supplements to small retail outlets across Southeast Asia.
They're our fastest growing market. So last financial year in FY22, Indonesia grew at 37%.
And with the world's Muslim population projected to reach about 3 billion by 2060, demand is only set to grow.
Nassim Kadem reporting there, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Since the FBI seized boxes of classified documents from Donald Trump's home, been reports they contain details of a foreign government's nuclear capabilities. That means he could face espionage charges. Today, a former FBI investigator on why, even if Donald Trump is found guilty and jailed, he could still run for president again, and probably will. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.